Okay, so good morning, everyone. So today we're going to continue talking about some things about C that you don't know because you know C++. But first, some selected anonymous feedback. Some people like asking questions this way. Though for this first question, you weren't going to get the answer fast enough. But if I finished the first lab before my lab time, did I still have to go? No, you didn't. Don't know that knowing that now is helpful, but this is going to be generally true for labs you can do outside of lab time. We don't care if you don't go. You're welcome to go anyways and ask the TAs about other things, assuming they aren't busy helping you will need to finish the lab, etc. How much extra credit is offered for each phase? So if you do more phases than are required for the bomb homework, more than the three, it's plus 2 out of 30 points if you don't have any explosions in completing the extra phase, and plus 1 out of 30 otherwise. Yes?
Is that saying that we have up to 30 points of extra credit, or what do you mean by 2 out of 30?
The assignment is out of 30, it's two additional points on that 30. So the maximum, so if you finish one extra phase, you can get 32 out of 30 on the homework. Yes?
While learning the extra credit, if we reach 20 explosions,
I think we correctly account for what phase the explosion happens at. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm pretty sure we do that correctly. Can we get keys to previous quizzes? So I don't have a convenient way of getting this for pre-fall 2016, because the quizzes are literally copy and pasted out of CoLab. And CoLab has an excellent interface for getting keys. Also, we might reuse some quiz questions. I'm reluctant to just give you the 2016 ones. Until this morning, the 2016 quizzes weren't obviously posted. They are now. This is on the Documents tab here, which is probably good to point out exists. We have old quizzes and old exams. So you might want to use those at some point. Maybe when we have an exam. And some other feedback. The quiz questions are overly difficult, and Lab 1's 20 explosions rule is overly punitive. Bear in mind that some of us have had only a few years of CS experience prior to this class. Yes, I try not to assume that anyone has any more CS experience than while they were at this university, since that's often the case. So for the quiz questions being difficult, I know I have a tendency to write hard quiz questions, and this is partly intentional. I want you to actually think about the reading and not just copy something from it, or the slides and not just copy something from it. But sometimes I inadvertently put a reference to something that's a bit later in the course that you may have seen before, but I probably shouldn't have put there, and I do make mistakes. We have the problem that quizzes have the shortest turnaround time of any assignment I give in this class, so they're the least edited. Sorry. As for the 20 explosions rule, I think if you're getting lots of explosions, you're making a systematic error in how you're approaching the bomb homework, and this is not going to make you progress. I'd like to note that many people have figured out that you can set a breakpoint in the function that runs to do the explosion stuff and type kill in your debugger before that happens, assuming you aren't typing enter over and over again in your debugger, which is probably the most common way to get an accidental explosion. Also, if you're typing step I or enter to repeat a step I over and over again, this is probably not a great strategy because you're probably not really paying attention to getting one. It's pretty error prone. But many people do this because they can't figure out how to set breakpoints in the places they want. And probably we should have had this in the lab write-up. It turns out you can set a breakpoint at a particular instruction given its address from the disassembly. And this is the syntax for doing that. So if you know the address is this hexadecimal number from this assembly, you can set a breakpoint on an instruction. Yes?
What's the lab write-up?
The thing that you read that was linked off the schedule that tells you about the lab.
Oh, okay. So it's not a season.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. The thing you read to start doing the lab.
Okay.
Which has a list of like GDB commands. I probably should have added this in there. I added a few this semester. We didn't previously tell you how to turn on Intel syntax mode, which some of you might like. But this is useful to know about, and some people I know don't. Yes?
Let's say in theory someone forgot that there was lab yesterday. Are they able to still like turn in work after the actual lab time or no?
So generally, this will not be true. For this lab, I believe we will accept it with a penalty. But generally, it will not be true because often after a lab, we will release a solution to the lab. And obviously, in those cases, we do not want to give you credit for finishing the lab late when you could have just copied and pasted the solution we released. Yes?
So for this particular lab, we had in order to get credit, it was to finish phase one. For future labs, will it be as strictly you have to reach this point in order to get credit?
So generally, we will set some point you have to finish to get credit. And usually, we want to grade on, did you make some progress? So we will look for like passing some test or something like that. But we'll have some expectation in the lab about what you should be able to finish in lab, and we'll check for usually less than that. Yes?
So given that there's no official submission for like lab documents, when exactly is the lab deadline? Is it at the end of your lab, at midnight, Wednesday?
So generally, the lab deadline will be 11 p.m. or like 11:59 p.m. the day of lab. We are not going to, with one exception, we are not going to try to figure out what lab you're supposed to be in and all that. And that one exception we will announce in advance as something that has to be on lab. So if it's done on the day of lab, that's going to be good enough. And we think it's possible to do all the lab and reasonable to do all the labs in the laptop. Yeah?
Is the 20 exposure rule for the entire, all 3 phases or per phase?
We will start deducting points for the first phase after 20. The threshold is a little higher for the later phases. The number of points deducted is probably less than you think. This is mainly there because if you're getting lots of explosions, you are probably have the wrong approach and you should rethink it, maybe talk to a TA or something like that. Any other sort of non-anonymous feedback questions?
Yeah. When you're saying like, when you talk about the X credit, so yep. You said like plus two, there's no explosions. Is that no explosions when they're doing that phase? Or
no explosions attributed to that phase. So other questions, comments? Yeah.
I've never used the lab. Machines like not during lab. Are there times when they're open that you just walk in?
There are. I do not know exactly what those are offhand. We might have the schedule posted. It's basically whenever other classes aren't using them, but I don't have that memorized. You should be able to remotely log into to Lab Unix 0, 1, 2, and 3, which yeah. I would recommend being able to do because. You might want to do the lab when some other class has a lab, do homeworks. Yeah. But yeah, you can generally go into the lab when other classes aren't using them. I just don't have that schedule off the top of my head. All of you should have key card access. The lab uses a proximity card. This is the type which you don't scan, but you beep out a reader. If you have an old ID card, you might not have that kind. And you can get a new replacement one which supports that for free. So, other questions, comments? So last time we talked about the sort of compilation process and a bit about reviewing x86-64 assembly, which hopefully will help you finish the lab and homework. We talked about C data types and what the single false value in C was, and a bit about pointer arithmetic, and we finished up on arrays and pointers. So any questions about these topics from last time? Okay, so some final notes about arrays and pointers. So I said last time that this syntax you think of as being an array thing in C is exactly pointer arithmetic. It takes advantage of the array implicitly converting to a pointer to its first element and then doing arithmetic on that pointer, which adds according to the size of the the element of the array. So it advances by that number of array elements. And a lot of people sort of get the impression that arrays and pointers are the same thing based on this. And they are quite similar, but there are some important differences. So here's an array and a pointer. So this is legal. This is the arrays decaying into pointers. So we're trying to use this array as a pointer. So it's going to turn into a pointer to its first element. It's going to be exactly the same as if I wrote this syntax for get the first element of the array, just really this pointer arithmetic, and take a point, get a pointer to it. Signing the other way around is not legal. You might have guesses as to what it would do. Doesn't matter. It's not legal. You just can't assign things to arrays. Even other arrays. Yes.
So they're kind of like static pointers.
So sort of. There's some other differences we'll get to, which make that not actually a good analogy. That's one thing. So you just can't do this. There are reasonable things you might imagine this would do. You might imagine it would copy things. You might imagine it would change the location of the array. It doesn't do any of them. It's just an error. So the other difference is size of. So size of is an operator which tells you how many bytes something takes up. If you ask the size of an array, it tells you the size of the thing that stores, size of all its elements put together. So 100 integers, each integer is 4 bytes, so that's 400. If you ask for the size of a pointer, it tells you how much space it takes to store that memory address. And this is the case where that sort of analogy of a static pointer breaks down. The compiler really thinks differently of these for how big they are. And if you ask for the size of a pointer to the first element explicitly, this is going to be the size of an address. Because that's explicitly an address. So the thing to remember is that it's when I say arrays decay into pointers, it's they churn into pointers when you try to use them as one. This is not trying to use the array as a pointer. Yeah?
How would you get like the size of an element in the array?
So a size of just array bracket 0 will give you that. Yeah?
So if you're trying to figure out like how long an array is, like you would have to actually know like, the size of the elements, but you have to know that it
was an integer. You can write size of array divided by size of array 0 to find this number of elements in an array. And this will not work for a pointer. This will take the size of the pointer divided by the size of the thing it points to. It doesn't know how much stuff is around the thing it points to. Yes?
If the function is set up to take in an array, can you set in a pointer instead?
So if a function takes an array of a known size, no. If a function takes an array of an unknown size, then you're actually passing a pointer. Even if you write right, this is a lie. This is actually a pointer. This is actually exactly the same as this. It's just different syntax. That's confusing, I know. You would really expect that to actually be an array and like size of not to work like a pointer, but it's actually really a pointer. Yes?
Then why don't you have to dereference it, like, for array?
What do you mean? So, because this is array 0 is the same as array plus 0 dereferenced. That's always equivalent. So the dereferencing is implied by the brackets. Yes?
So, after each of those three subroutines, let's say you assign a separate array to that pointer. Would that work for both of them?
So it would work for both of them. So this is These are equivalent. So this is just a confusing way of specifying a pointer parameter. And if you pass an array to it, it's going to, you're trying to use it as a pointer. So it's going to turn into a pointer to the first element of the array.
So if you say array equals pointer,
what do you mean array equals pointer? Like this?
Yeah, but let's say you like instantiate the array
first. So this is an error if it's an array. So that's was that's this case. It's an error if it's an array. The other way around is legal. It's just always an error. You don't even need to think about what it should do. It's just invalid. So you could do for pointer equals yes. So in foo, I could do pointer equals array where array is declared somewhere. Yes, this is really exactly the same, which is very confusing. I just say my advice is do not use this. What? So you can use array equals, so you can't use array equals pointer, but.
For both of them?
For both of them, yeah.
The question is, do you use the pointer bracket equals some other pointer?
Pointer bracket bracket.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's what bracket bracket equals passed down.
Oh, you're asking if you can do this. The answer is no, because C does not support default arguments. Not because it's an incompatible type, because C just doesn't let you do that. Doesn't let you specify default arguments for functions. So other questions, confusion, way back there?
Is there a performance difference between star pointer and int pointer brackets?
No, they are really exactly the same. Yeah.
You said that line 1 was legal, like that would work on line.
Which line 1? Sorry. Which line? Tell me exactly which line on this.
Size of array divided by
size. So no, sorry. This does work. This is legal.
Oh.
This gives you is the number of elements.
I don't know why I thought I heard you say that. That works.
Sorry. Yeah.
In the volume, so you said like if you pass in an array as an argument, in the parameter list, that then it's automatically a pointer, right?
If you have an array without a size.
Okay, so then does that mean that in the body of the method, you can set it to like an array or no?
Yes, so this is actually legal.
Okay.
Which is very confusing, which is why I just say, just don't do this, okay. Because it's unnecessarily confusing. Yeah.
So that first line implies that you have dynamic type in an array. Yes.
C arrays have one type that they contain elements of, and that's it. Yeah.
But let's say at line 6,
mm-hmm.
you have array equals pointer. Would that be legal?
No.
Okay. So even if the parameter is set.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. This is legal, and it would be illegal here. Yeah.
How do you pass in an array
with a known size? So I believe you can do something like this, and then bar array. I think you can do that. I'm not sure, actually. I'll just mark this as question. This is not commonly done, and I don't really recommend doing it. If it is legal, I'm not sure if it is. Yeah.
So there's no real way to pass an array if you want to
do it? There's no elegant way to pass in an array. I think you could pass in fixed size, I'm pretty sure you can do like this. But variable size, you pass a pointer and a size. So the typical thing, so you commonly see C functions which are array int pointer int size, which do something like this for that reason. Yeah.
So can you use the bracket notation to read the value at any memory address from any pointer? So just some random pointer and just see what the bytes are for.
So the short answer is yes. The longer answer is kind of, and we'll get to one of the kind of reasons later today. Okay. So any more questions on this topic? Okay, so other differences between arrays and pointers. So last time I showed you a syntax for initializing strings. I'd like to just point that out because I kind of glossed over it. So this makes a pointer to a constant string that's stored in a read-only data segment somewhere in our program that you're not supposed to write to the thing this pointer points to because it's just a constant. And it's a pointer because that's how strings are represented in C. This creates an actual array which will have a copy of this string. So space will be allocated for the array large enough for the string, including the null terminator, if this is a local variable on the stack, otherwise in global read-write space. And you can actually write to that because it's a copy. So any questions about this? Yeah.
Why do you say probably points to read only?
The compiler is not required to put it in the read-only area. So it's possible that writing to it would not be an error, but it would probably cause weird things to happen. Like it could be that if you have two copies of the string in your code, they both point to the same thing. And if you write to one, you'll modify the other constant string. Yes. So that is legal. You can, in fact, remove this const. And it doesn't change anything about what happens if you try to write through this pointer, except that it makes the compiler not complain about it. But it still was going to be an error to write through the pointer. So unlike C++, C is not very picky about some const. So it will let you get rid of const when it probably shouldn't. And this is one of those cases. Yeah?
So technically, it would still be read-only data?
So it would still point to read-only data. You just have a pointer which isn't const. So the compiler will compile the code to write to that read-only data, but the code won't work.
Is that just like a distinction because it's a string as opposed to, because it seems like from earlier, if you had a list of numbers, these two would be the same.
So basically, this is an historical artifact that in old C, people didn't have const, and C didn't want to change how string constants worked. So yes, it is special for strings. It just doesn't enforce the constantness when you would hope it would. Yeah?
So if you did size of array, that's what we call a girl, would it actually be like one cell bigger than you expected?
If you did, yeah, so it would give you, so if you did size of array here, it would be the number of characters in this string, including the null terminator, so one bigger than you might expect by just counting what you see here. Any other questions about this? Yeah.
So you said that an array with empty brackets is a pointer when it's not initialized?
When it's in an argument list only. That's a special case only for function arguments. Yeah.
So you said that the array is a copy of the string. Isn't the read-only data also a copy of the string, but just a different location in memory?
They're conceptually, so this is a copy in the sense that the, like for a local variable, the compiler will generate code that actually copies the string to the stack, for example. Whereas for this, if there's multiple instances of the same string in your program, there's only going to be one. And it's just going to point to that one. Or there might only be one, I should say. Okay, so now I'm going to have a diversion away from C into Unix stuff, because you need to use Unix for this course, and there are some things that we have found in the past that you don't know about Unix. And one of these is about man pages. So there is a command called man for manual. And it tells you everything you could want to know, almost, about every single thing you can run in the command line. So let's start by wondering about how this man command that gives us a manual works. There we go. So man has a manual page. And it tells us it's an interface to the online reference manuals. And it gives us all the ways we can possibly run it. Quite exhaustively. So the brackets here represent something that's optional. And so this is all the sort of options you can provide to it. Many, many options. And then there's a description. It's quite thorough. Tells you how to interpret things. And there are examples. So if you want to know how OS works, type man OS. There are multiple sections of manual pages. And you can display all of them with -a. I'll show you why that matters in a bit. And you can also search for a keyword among the manuals with the -k option. So I can look for what man pages talk about printf, for example. And I can, I think there's an example. Well, we'll go to that. So let's talk about one particular command, which is, say, chmod. So chmod, this is a command to change file mode bits. So on your lab accounts, you have file permissions, which might vary. Maybe they've set them up correctly this year. Maybe they haven't, but we'll tell you about that. And this is a command to edit the file mode bits. And this sets whether other people can, for example, read your home directory. As I would usually do, the easiest thing to do is to find the example section of this man page. There is one, and if not, we will just deal with the options. So chmod, it takes a mode and some files, and it changes, say, whether I can read them or not. We'd like you to possibly be familiar with that. So this is an example chmod command. So there's a --- recursive option. So if you look at the man page, it's going to tell you that that's going to apply the chmod command to all the parts of the to files and directories recursively, meaning it's not just going to change the file you specify, but if it's a directory, it's going to change all the files in that directory and all the directories in that directory. And then there's this funny OG-R thing, and then a file name, which is someone's home directory. My home directory, presumably. And the way these flags work is that the first part specifies who the permissions are for. So others and group. So others meaning not me and not the group I'm in. And group meaning the group I'm in, which for most of your lab accounts is the student group, as opposed to some other group. The minus means remove some permissions. And the R stands for the ability to read those files. So it used to be the case, at least, maybe they fixed this, and you can check with ls, that home directories were world readable. And this would change that. So not everyone can read your home directory. And it's useful to know otherwise if you run into permission denied problems or actually need to share files in the future. thought you should know actually how to use Unix since you're using it. Yes?
So does this mean, when you're saying like groups, you don't mean that you're changing it for yourself, right?
Yes, you're not changing it for yourself. So the option to change it for yourself is U for user, meaning the user who owns those files. And there's you can add do plus to add, and you can also add execute permission to something. Yes?
So if you have, like, say, a directory, and it's just root access, and you want to make it non-root access, how would you do that?
So if you're root, you can change the permissions for others to be able to read and write it. If you're not root, you can try to do that, but you'll probably get a permission denied message.
So, okay.
Yeah.
So the fact that you can set read and write permissions independently, would it then be possible to block read access but allow write access? And what would that?
That is possible. And some people actually use that for real things. Like, I've known institutions where that was a way people handed in files. Like, you made a directory people could write but not read. It's not a common practice, but it's not useless. So this might come up a bit. So if you have funny permission things, and I didn't check whether this is necessary this semester. We did tell them about this problem, but I don't know if they had time to actually change the account configuration. So another useful command is tar. So again, we can look at the man page to find out what tar is, and it says the GNU version of the tar archiving utility. That's not actually very useful. So it stores and extracts files from a tape or disk archive. So it takes an archive and will often give you a tar archive. In fact, we gave you one for Bomb Lab. And you'll need to get files out of it. Maybe it would also be useful to be able to create these. So this man page will tell you about the options for creating, comparing, and rid of things. And tar is a bit of a weird command because it's kind of old. So our basic usage here is that if you want to just see what's in a tar file without actually extracting it, you want to make sure that you're putting it in the right place, see what directories it creates. The command is tar t for table of contents, and then f for file. Why do you have to say you want a file? Because the default is a tape drive. Probably don't have a tape drive, but this utility comes from the days when tape drives were what you usually use this for. Yes?
What does usually better for compression? Does this compress the files at all or no?
So these commands I'm showing you here do not do any compression. There are options you can pass to tar, which are in the man page, which do compression. And typically those files will have a different extension than .tar.
Oh, okay. Do they compress files usually? Like, are they more compressed or less compressed or the same as zip files?
It varies. Unlike zip, tar compression occurs after you make the archive, which usually means it does a little better at the cost of being a little harder to extract a single file. But it varies because they're slightly different compression mechanisms. So this is useful. So if we give you a tar archive and you want to see what files is it going to put in this directory, do I want to create a new directory for this or something, you can list it that way. You can extract an archive with X. And there's a V option, which I recommend using, which is verbose. You can also pass it multiple times, and it might be more verbose. It might tell you more about what's going on. So if you just type tar XF, it will extract the archive and not tell you anything about the files it's creating, which I find confusing. You can just type ls and suddenly there's more files. You don't really know what those are. So if you use xvf, it will list the files it's creating as it's creating them. And you can also specify an individual file in the archive to extract with after the file. You can also create archives with cvf. So V again is verbose. You don't need to provide it, but I like knowing what files are being put in my archive. But if you don't want to know that until you type tar tf, you can omit that, save space in your command line. You just specify a file name to create and a directory. You can also add to existing archives. It will just append the files to the archive. Yes?
The compressed one called the .gz.
So there's multiple ways of compressing tar archives. So one is that tar.gz. And as the file name would suggest, it's actually someone, the process is you create a tar archive and then run a compressing program called gzip on it.
Oh, okay.
Which there is an option for the tar command to do that for you.
Oh, okay. And Windows can open that gz or no?
You can find programs on Windows which will open tar archives. Okay. We will not support them in this class. If you have problems with tar archives, we're going to say use a lab machine. Okay. So those are some useful commands besides our normal ones. Another thing I'd like to say is that there is some features of our shell, which many people don't know about, which is really nice to know about. So for example, there is tab completion. So I want to go to a directory, and I don't want to type out the full name of the directory, let's say. And I know I have a Spring 2017 directory in my home directory. So I can type the first few letters of that, and then press tab. And the shell actually types the rest of it for me. You know, and then I know I have a 3330 directory in here. I can just go to that. And if you have a case where you have multiple things which match, so I have another directory in there, if I press tab, it doesn't do anything the first time. If I press tab again, it will list the possibilities. So this is a useful thing to know about, so you don't have to type out your full file and directory names all the time. This also works for commands. I want to know what some command which starts with TA. Don't remember what it is. I can figure out what those commands are. And if it was unambiguous, I could just, in the case where it's unambiguous, I don't have compress. So I know I have a command starting with gz. I can type just gz and see what those are, type gzi and get gzip. So this works in like most places you'd expect to finish typing something. You can press tab and maybe press tab twice if it's ambiguous to get a list of the possibilities rather than typing out full file names and directory names. Another thing is that we have history in our shell. So there's a history command which shows me all the commands I've ran recently. So if you want to remember some command you ran recently, you can use the history command. Yes? I think with our configuration for the lab machines, yes.
Is there a way to like enter in the line number of your history and like run that command again?
Yes, there is. So let's say I want to run man again, and this history command says it's command 2000. I can type !2000, and that will rerun that. And you can find all about this by reading the man page for your shell, which is bash, which is way too long and I'm not going to go through. But the main things you want to know that history exists, so if you have a command you typed previously and want to look it up, you can do that. Also, in addition to being able to use the history command, which has a man, which that's probably not the man page for it. But in addition to the history command, I can use up arrow and down arrow to go through my history of commands. So if you type out a command, you can use up arrow and then edit. Editing in my shell is a little weird, but and then edit the command with the arrow keys and backspace and so on. Yeah?
Sorry, I have one question as well. What, is it common practice for like programmers to clear the bash history? Because I heard like that it is.
Some people do that, some people don't. If you don't want it in your history, when you pay mouse up, you hinge up, if you don't want people to see what commands you run. Yeah?
What's your favorite command line text?
Well, I used Vim, but I'm not. That's not a recommendation. I'm just used to it. Like when people ask what to use for this class, I'm probably going to say Nano or Pico because I do not want to teach anyone how to use a text editor. So I'm teaching you about this command history and tab completion mainly because in office hours I like look over people typing commands and I'm like, oh, this could be so much faster. So hopefully this will do something about that. Okay. So with that note, let's go back to C. So one thing you've seen in the examples I've shown is that we don't use IOStream because that doesn't exist in C. Instead, we use standard IO.h. And you might wonder, what's in standard IO.h? How could I ever find that out? Wouldn't it be nice if I had a manual? Well, turns out that we have a manual. So I can type man standard IO.h. Or sorry, just standard IO. I could type man minus k standard IO.h if I. So I could do man minus k standard io.h and not be told anything. So, but man standard io, and this works if you omit the .h for most of the C libraries. And it says, oh, this is the standard input-output library routines. It defines a standard in, a standard out, and a standard error. And if we go down in this man page, we get a list of all the functions. Isn't that handy? And you know, so we can find, for example, in here, the printf function is listed, formatted output conversion. So I've shown printf in a prior example. I didn't really say what it does. But we can, in fact, look up printf man page, and something confusing happens. This isn't the man page to printf. This is the printf C function. This looks like a command you run from the command line. So it turns out there's a command called printf. So one thing we might remember from man is that the first example was dash A to display all of the versions of a man page. So you can say, that's not the printf I want. Let's look for all the versions of printf. So first it displays this one, which is printf in section 1. And that's not the one I want, so I'm going to press Q to quit. And then it's going to say, next I'm going to show you printf in section 3. And oh, that looks like the one I want. And this will tell you all about printf. I'll give a simpler, shorter explanation, but that's the authoritative list of everything printf does. And if you want to go directly to that man page, if you know it's in section 3, which I do from this, you can type man, the section number, and then printf, and get right there. Yes?
So what is it pulling from?
There are a bunch of files in a system directory.
So just knows all those standard C libraries?
There's just a bunch of manual files in user share man or something that man looks at. So let's go through an example of printf. So printf is basically your equivalent for what you usually do with cout. So here's an example of using printf not just to print out a constant string, but to do the equivalent of this, basically. And you'll note that we have these placeholders here, which start with a percent sign and then have some letter after it indicating what kind of placeholder they are. So this percent D here represents an integer placeholder, and this percent S represents a string placeholder. And corresponding to each of the placeholders, we have an argument of the appropriate type to printf. So rather than having it inline like you're used to with cout, it's afterwards. And it needs to match in type. Yes?
Could you do it inline? what's the...
No.
No, you're just...
That is not allowed. Yes.
We can have, like, a mismatch of, like, variable names and the placeholder.
So if the placeholders mismatch, bad things happen. Hopefully you get an error. If you don't, something weird will happen when you run the code. Yes.
When you say we can't do it in line, do you mean we can't use C out at all, or we can't put in...
So in C, you can't use C out at all. And there is no way of moving this cuss no into the middle of this string. You have to have it, it has to be the second argument or later. So the second placeholder of the string has another corresponding argument. Yeah? You always have to do the slash n. There's not a shorthand for that. There's no equivalent of endl. So we have this string with placeholders is called a format string. It's the format of the output we're giving. And it much masks the types of the arguments. If you don't, maybe you'll get an error, otherwise something really strange will happen and there might be no diagnostics for it. So you just be careful for that. And you might say, well, %d for an int argument, %s for a string, what else is there? What else can I print out? And here is a non-exhaustive table of common things you might want to print out. So we saw %s, so that expects some sort of character pointer. And it prints it out as a null terminated string. If there's no null terminator, it's going to keep going until it finds something or it crashes. There's %p, which prints out any pointer as sort of something like this. So that's useful for debugging, if you want to know what a pointer is. Probably not useful to show to normal users. They probably don't care what a pointer is, points to address-wise. Then there's various ways of printing out integers. So there's %d, %u, and %x. These all expect ints or unsigned ints. They do not expect longs. If you want a long, you need to add an l. So %ld is the same as %d, but for a long. %lu is the same as %u, but for an unsigned long. And it may work if you don't do this, it may not. But it's an error not to match the types correctly. And yes, you can really put an int or a short or a char and it's perfectly fine. Yes, I know that doesn't make any sense. That is the rule that C has. Yes?
I think I might have missed it. What's the difference between U
and X? So, sorry, X is printing out as hexadecimal. So this is the same value, so 2A instead of 42. Okay. Yeah.
And then, one more, something that I never quite understood. What's the difference between %p and %i?
I don't know it offhand. I don't know if it's significant. It's in the man page somewhere, if there is a difference. I think one might be supported more places than the other, but I'm not sure. So there's also ways of printing out floating point numbers. And so %f gives you the format with the number followed by some number of zeros. %e gives you scientific notation, and %g chooses between scientific notation and the number followed by some number of zeros based on whether it seems to fit or not. So for 42, it chooses to print out something simple. For some very small value, it actually uses scientific notation rather than printing out all zeros or printing out a whole bunch of zeros and then 0.42. Also, sometimes you might want to print out a percent sign. You can do that by using two percent signs. And yes, these floating point things really accept a double or a float. Yes, that doesn't make sense. Yeah?
For no argument, do you still have to do like comma, comma? Or is it just...
If you have if you don't have any percent signs in your string, you mean? No placeholders?
If you do percent, percent. If you like percent, percent, and like say you have like two strings and your percent, percent's in the middle, so like would you
Sorry.
Have two parameters?
The percent, percent doesn't use any arguments, so yeah, you shouldn't add any commas,
so
any additional argument.
Two arguments, if you had three and one of them is percent, percent.
That's right.
Okay.
So other questions about printf? So as I said, the full, complete, detailed docs for printf, including how to do things like, let's say I don't want 6 digits after the decimal, things like that, all in man3 printf. And textbook goes over it a little bit, but not very thoroughly. Yeah.
So how does printf work in regards to method overloading? Because you have a variable amount of input going into the function.
Yeah, so we're not going to talk about how to implement this. If you want to look up the way you can write functions like printf and C, the thing to look up is stdarg, which is a standard library header for variable argument functions. I'm not going to go into talk about that much in this class, and there's some surprisingly tricky bits, which are basically why you can have int shorter care and it still works. But basically the way it works from an assembly point of view is that we pass arguments to printf just like we would with the calling convention, and somehow printf is going to figure out based on the first argument where to get the other arguments, which it can do because it knows the type of the argument enough from what's in the string, and therefore where it is, what register to read it from, or where in the stack to get it from. Other questions? Yes. So this string is somewhere in the read-only data part of our program. It's just a normal string constant. Okay, so some final little nits from C. So there's some features of C which exist in C++ that you haven't used very much. So one of those is goto. I'm going to mention it because you might see it. I'm not going to say I particularly recommend using it, but it in fact exists and does what you would guess. So here, this conditionally jumps out of these 2 nested for loops down to here. And I chose this example because this is a defensible use of goto. I'm not saying you should do this, but it's defensible. Yes. Question? Yeah.
So it never goes back into the for loop.
That's great. It just skips right out of the for loop all through there. Yeah.
Does it have to skip down, or can it go up?
It can go up too. It needs to be in the same function. And I believe there's some rules about not crossing like variable declarations and things like that. Yeah.
It's like the difference between this and just like breaking out
multiple
times.
Could it's
even break out multiple times here.
I'm not with one break statement.
You'd have to
have an if I bricked out sort of thing.
Is there a way to do that?
Not in C. Besides having like a flag variable or something. Not really. Yeah.
This translates pretty literally into assembly right?
Yes. This literally could be implemented exactly that way. It may or may not be. But that is completely valid for your compiler to do. And you should expect the semantics to be like that, including with respect to what happens to variables and things like that. Other questions? Yeah?
What really is bad about this?
So this example, as I said, is a defensible use of goto. If you're using goto when there is actually something like break, you're probably making a mistake. In this case, there's not something like break which can substitute for this. So this is fine. Some people will tell you not to do it. I think this is okay. But people often try to avoid goto because it's often used in ways which are quite confusing instead of something like this. Okay, so finally, for something a little different. So you've seen structs in C++?
Yeah.
So who can tell me what a struct in C++ is? Yeah.
It's like almost an object that has no methods.
Okay, so one option is almost an object, but it has no methods. Any other?
It's basically a collection of our primitive data types.
So this is what you've been taught a struct in C++ is. That's almost right. So in C++, it turns out, a struct is the same as a class, actually literally the same, even though we don't tell you to do this, except that it defaults to public instead of private. In C, structs are different. There's no such thing as methods anywhere. And structs work differently. So one thing you may notice that's different is that in this example code, I have typed struct rational to declare an instance of the struct. I didn't type rational, I typed struct rational, and that was required. I could not have typed rational. Yes?
If you did type def struct rational, can you then?
Yes, we'll get to that in a second. But without that, as is, I cannot type rational, I have to type struct rational, and you'll see it. But this works probably as you've seen in C++, so you set declare a struct, set two variables, and we have a pointer to it, and we can use this shorthand notation to access the struct through a pointer, which is exactly the same as dereferencing the struct, and then using the dot operator. So if I don't want to keep typing struct rational, which is awfully awkward, as mentioned, I can use a typedef. So I can define some struct with some random long name, and then I can use a typedef to give a shorter name for that. In this case, rational. Just rational, not struct rational. And I can use that type the same thing as the where I used struct rational for before. So this makes sense? Yeah.
I've never used typedef.
Okay, so typedef defines a new name for a type. And the syntax for typedef is that it's exactly like declaring a variable, except you put typedef in front of it, and the name of the variable you would be declaring is the name of the new type. So in this case, I could, without typedef, this would be declaring something called rational, which is an instance of struct other name for rational. With typedef, it says rational is another name for struct, other name for rational. And you can use this, not this with structs, but with any type. I can typedef int, int, other name for int, and have a new name for ints I can use. You can use it with any type, yeah. So it gives you another name for the type for all going forward, wherever this is in scope. Yeah.
It's like a benefit for this, aside from like,
the benefit, I mean, the main benefit of this is that it's easier to type and hopefully to read. The other benefit is that sometimes you'll, for integer types, like you'll want to figure out what type of integer to use once and not have to, and be able to change your mind quickly. Yeah?
Is it legitimate to say typedef struct other name for rational and then define it, and then at the end say rational and then followed by a semicolon?
What do you mean? And then, yes, we will get to that in a second. It is, and I'll show you. Okay, so this is our sort of long-handed way where we've defined this long struct type, and then we've made a short alias for it that we can use. So, as mentioned, I can do struct other name for rational and make a new name for that type that's shorter, or I can do this all in one line. This is just a way of writing the same thing in one line. And this creates two types. So it creates a type called struct, other name for rational, and a type called rational. So it's, whereas we can do this too, which you'll commonly see in C code, which only creates a type called rational. So it's almost the same, because usually we're not going to use this long type name here, but it just doesn't define that extra struct other name for rational type. Yes?
So that last sentence would be the most common problem?
This is, yeah, a common form you'll see in C programs, which is why we're telling you about it, because you're likely to see it. And you might also see this form. I'll give you an example of why in a bit. So something I'd like to point out is that other name for rational is not a valid type. It's struct other name for rational. The struct is not optional. It's not like C++ in that respect. Okay. Any questions about this? Yeah.
Can you do like type def struct rational and then also name it rational?
Yes. So you could do rational and put some stuff here. Rational. You can do that. That is legal. And this creates two types. So struct rational and rational. The namespaces for struct something and normal types are independent. So if I like change this to, so they can have conflicts in them and they could be different types, which I don't recommend doing. The reason I have other name for rational in all my examples is to emphasize that they're different namespaces. But this is something you might see. Yes?
Wait, let's say you don't use type def. Could you name your variable rational, like struct rational and rational?
This is also legal. And confusingly, create is equivalent to struct rational and then rational rational, which is also very confusing. So I will show you it's equivalent to, like, with different names, it's just that. It turns out that defining the struct rational doesn't prohibit you from using the name rational as a variable name, which is not true in C++. I do not recommend ever taking advantage of this. But it might come up if you're wondering, why isn't this an error? That's why. Yeah?
Do you struct them as curly braces, non-rational, and that just be a variable called rational?
So you're asking if I do, like, some stuff in here and why? I think so. This might not be legal. If it's legal, it does that. Okay. Any other questions about this? So you might wonder, I don't like typing struct all the time. Why do we bother doing this? And we're going to give, why do we bother having two names for structs? That's silly. And you might wonder why we're doing that. And there's one case where we need to take advantage of that. And classically, that's with a linked list. So this is declaring a linked list where we have in each node of the list, which is represented by a struct list T, also called a list, has an item, that's the value in that node, and a pointer to the next node. And I couldn't use list star here because that type doesn't exist until this semicolon. So I had to use the name I used in the struct because that exists earlier. Yes?
If you put the list at the top, it did like type def struct list.
That might work, but typically not what I've seen done. So we can then use this as a normal list. I'll also point out that, I think most people have seen malloc. People have seen malloc. So we're going to use malloc. So this is typical use of malloc. You can't use new, it doesn't exist. And malloc should be paired with free. We'll go into that in next week's lab. And this is sort of how I typically use this sort of list struct. And this makes head is a pointer to an instance of the struct, which points to has a next pointer to null after we initialize it. So any questions about this? So key thing to note C-wise is that, yeah, we needed to use the struct version rather than the type def because to keep everything in one line, the shorter type wasn't defined until the semicolon. Okay, so this is one way of getting variable-sized data structures in C. Another one is going to be dynamic arrays. And in C++, hopefully you use vector for this, but you don't have that in C. So we can declare an array. We can allocate space for 100 integers with malloc. And then we can just do access through a pointer to that using our brackets notation, which remember just does pointer arithmetic. This is our sort of dynamically allocated array. You'll commonly see this all over in C++. And because we allocated with malloc, we free with free. And this would be equivalent to new int 100 in C and delete brackets, new int 100 in C++ and delete brackets in C++. There's no distinction between allocating arrays and allocating other things in C, so there's not two forms of delete, or free rather. Yeah. So no, you don't. So malloc returns void star, and in C, there's a special rule that void star will implicitly convert to any pointer type without a cast. You can cast it, and it is not, and it is perfectly fine to do so if you feel more comfortable with that. But it is in fact legal not to cast it like this. And if you're people who usually write C, you usually see them not cast it. So this gives a array as a pointer to 400 bytes on the heap, which is our which we initialize to 0 through 99. So you might say, well, I've really liked vectors, and I liked how they had a size with them. You know, I like to be able to do dot size. Can we get something kind of like that? And sure, we can make a data structure like that. We'll call it a range. And it will have a size and a pointer to some data. So we've basically recreated vector. So you can create a vec, initialize, set its size, so track its size, just manually do what vector would do, initialize its data, and then we can access it, and we have a dot size now. It's a little less convenient than a vector, perhaps, but this gives you basically what you were used to in C, probably. C++, probably. Yes? Yeah, it might be better called the list node. You'll commonly see it called the list because people like having the thing that's the that you put in a structure to have a linked list be called a list. Okay, so yeah, this is declaring it, and this is copying it from one to the other using that size member. So one question should be able to answer here is, why couldn't I have just wrote range vec2 equals vec? And you might, and if you're wondering whether that's legal, yes, it's legal. Yeah.
The pointer for data ends up equaling this pointing to the same address.
Yeah. So if I did range vec2 equals vec, so if I assign one struct to the other, what C is going to do is going to, that's legal, it's going to do that, it's going to copy each member of the structure exactly. So it will take vec2.data and set it to equal to vec.data. So we'll have two vectors which point to the exact same data, so if you modify one, you'll modify the other. It won't actually make a copy. But in C++, when you did this, it actually makes a copy. Yeah?
So with this, you just have to like know that you're going to have to account for the size. Like it doesn't stop you.
Yes, it's not going to stop you. That's mostly, that's true if you use the bracket syntax on C++ vectors. Yeah, it's not going to stop you. It's not going to check the size for you. You might get a crash, maybe. Maybe not. Okay. Other questions, comments? I saw. So I'm going over these various ways of representing lists because we're also going to have a lab, homework, which uses them a bit just for practice and see. We're going to use one other type, which is a sentinel terminated array, which is basically the same idea as this, but instead of having a size, we just say we put some dummy element at the end of the array to say it's the end. which is exactly how C strings work. So C strings use ASCII 0. Well, we'll use something different because we'll have like an array of shorts, and 0 is often something you want in an array of shorts. But that's another common way you'll see code representing a variable length array. I didn't give that in my examples of structs because typically you'll just represent that as a single pointer, just like we do with strings as a char star. Okay, and one final thing, or choose one thing. So we have signed and unsigned types. I think you've seen this before. Before I finish up, I'd like to go over one non-intuitive thing. So what do you think the result of this should be? So who thinks it should be 1? Thinks it should be 0? Who thinks it should be an error? No one thinks it should be an error? That's surprising. Well, the result is 0, the trap result. And that doesn't make any sense, and it's really confusing. So to avoid this, don't compare signed to unsigned. What happens is that they both get converted to unsigned first. I'm sorry. There's in fact some complicated rules that I'm, given the time we have, I won't go over. You can look it up. But basically, don't compare signed to unsigned. If you give the right flags to your compiler, you get a warning about this. Just don't do it. And so another thing in our last 3 minutes I'll go over is what should this do? So int max is the largest possible value of the int type. So back there? You should think you should get 0. So that would be true if it was unsigned int. That would be a good idea. Oh, so 0, right. You get 0. You say you get 0 because int max plus 1 is a negative number. Yeah, sorry, I forgot what the comparison was. So that would be, you know, what you'd expect to get. You'd expect to get 0. And if you don't, if you just compile this normally without optimizations, you'll get 0. If you compile it with optimizations, you'll get 1, and the compiler is not wrong. The people who wrote the specification for C didn't specify what some things do. And one of those things is overflowing a signed integer. So this is called undefined behavior. And this let the compiler decide, oh, I can just assume that this doesn't overflow, which is the common case and makes things a lot faster, and just turn this into assign 1 to my result. And the people who defined what C was decided that they wanted to give compilers this leeway rather than having this strict model of things wrapping around. So this is true for signed integer overflow. It is not true for unsigned. Unsigned does what you expect. But this is just the rule that they've defined. And there's other examples of undefined behavior. One example of them is, we alluded to earlier, can I just use pointer arithmetic to access any bit of memory? Well, if you use pointer arithmetic to go outside the bounds of the object you got the pointer to, like the array or whatever it is, that's undefined behavior. So the compiler could do some optimization like this where it does something where it just says that can never happen. So any questions about what's happening here? The compiler generating, assuming that this doesn't happen? Yeah.
What were you saying about it being unsigned int versus being?
So if this was an unsigned int, this would not be a legal optimization. That's just what the standard said. They decided to make unsigned ints do this because it's commonly used enough, but not signed ints. Signed ints, they decided to give the compilers the freedom. So generally, in undefined behavior, compilers can do whatever they want. So if you do int max plus 1 in your code, your compiler can do whatever it wants with that, including different things each time, including crashing your program. And okay, so any questions about this before, as I finish up?